are no single magnetic charges, these do not exist. As far as we know, no one has ever observed one. People have tried. People tried to make them. People have tried to look for them just out there in the cosmos. But nobody has ever seen one of these things. They're called magnetic monopoles because there's only one pole on the magnet, north pole, south pole. Monopole would be either a north or a south by itself. Take a magnet like this, chop the north pole off, you'll have a north and a south pole now. Magnetic field lines emanate from the north pole and go to the south pole. We've never observed a magnet where there's only, for instance, emanation from the magnet. In other words, if you were to take and chop the north pole off of this thing, and then take a south pole and move it around the magnet, it would attract one end and repel the other, just like electric charge does, like and unlike charges attracting and repelling. Or repelling and attracting. So, in a simple model of a magnet, the simplest magnet contains both a north and a south pole. And by convention, field lines emanate from the north pole and enter the south pole. Okay? So when you're thinking about your magnetic field, those are your directions. Okay? If you have, for instance, a magnetic field that's uniform in some region of space and it points to the right, then there must be a north pole over here and a south pole over here. Just like an analogy with electric charge, there may be a positive charge on the left and a negative charge on the right, by convention. Electric field lines exit from, they emanate from positive charges and go to negative charges. Magnetic fields go from north to south. Okay, so it's a convention. All right, so when I draw the Earth's magnetic field, by convention we call them north-north, and so that's where the magnetic field lines of the Earth emanate from and they enter the south. And if you were to chop the Earth in half, if it were really purely pure magnet, then you suddenly have a south pole at the equator and the north pole where it was before. Now, electric fields, we denoted electric fields with E, okay? And that was, we defined the electric force per unit charge, okay? Magnetic fields are denoted with B. Sorry about that. B. B is our symbol. B vector. Okay, just like the electric field was a vector, the magnetic field is a vector. Okay, let's do some experiments. First of all, let me show you that in fact, can actually see, the magnets are great because they're macroscopic properties. Basically, I'll do that. Science is hard. Their macroscopic properties lend themselves toward fairly easy visualization. I think I was playing around with this thing yesterday. Let's see if I can mix up some of these little iron filings. So this is basically a little water tank with tiny little iron grains in it. And each piece of iron is itself a little north-south pole. And if I leave this magnet here for a few minutes, you'll begin to see the iron filings lining up as their little north and south poles try to point along the little magnetic field lines. Okay, so again, this one over here, this is our north pole. Okay, so field lines by convention are emanating out of here and then coming back to the south pole over here. And you can see the iron filings are beginning to line up. So each of their little south poles is aligning to point up with the north pole of the big magnet. And then that causes the iron filing next to it to have its little south pole line up with the north pole of the iron filing and so forth, all around the field. And you can really begin to see the field lines trace out. If we leave this here for a little while, it will become really obvious. If I could get the iron filings mixed up a little bit better, that would help too. But even in between here, you see there are magnetic field lines that are connecting from north to south here, and there are those that are sort of swinging out and coming back through here in the iron filing. So very analogous to a dipole, an electric dipole, where you have a positive and a negative charge separated by even a small distance. And that causes this characteristic pattern to emerge, where you have, we originally had plus and minus, and we had fields that look like this. Okay. This dipole field is the minimum simple field that you can have with magnetic charges, because we've never seen a single magnetic charge, a monopole, before. No one has ever observed a magnetic field that in its simplest form didn't look this complicated. Okay, the dipole is the simplest field type you can see in a magnet. Okay. Now this magnet's fine. It's nice. Let's get a better magnet. Let's get a rare earth magnet. You ever played with these before? These will wipe your credit cards completely clean. I'm not wearing my wallet today. Also because of that thing, because I do not know what the electromagnetic radiation from that would do to my wallet. This is a rare earth magnet. Okay? It is extremely powerful. If I were to put my hand between this and another rare earth magnet, it would likely break bones in my hand. Okay? So I'm going to be very careful with this thing. Watch what this does. I'm going to take one of the poles, okay, and I'm going to put it near these filings. So that's sort of what one pole would look like. Okay? Because I just stuck I don't know if that's the north or the south, but I stuck one of the poles closer to the iron filings. And look at them just get ripped into that thing.
Would it be south since it's going into it?
Well, except that what happens is each of those little iron filings is a magnet. So depending on which pole it's pointing to, it's aligned. So you at some point just label one of the poles north and south and kind of go from there. Alright, so let's actually turn this into a dipole. Let me mix this up a little bit better. It doesn't take much for this thing to really get the iron filings going crazy. See the lines here, curving in and out? Eventually it's just going to suck all these iron filings right underneath it. It's very powerful as a magnet. Okay? Now, without getting myself killed here, let me demonstrate some magnetic force. Now, I contend that just like with electric charges, north poles repel each other and south poles attract each other. Okay? So, let's see which pole I have down here in the bottom of this. I'm going to take the north pole of this magnet and line it up. I don't know if I'm going to do this. Okay. Okay, so, what was that? That was the south pole. So, here's the south pole of this magnet. That must be the south pole of the rare earth magnet because it's attracted to it. Okay? Let me try the north pole. It's a little repulsive. It doesn't want to... Come on. There we go. It doesn't want to go on very easily. But I can flip the magnet over. You can do all kinds of crazy things with this. Right? They get it to spin around. Okay. You can kind of see where motors come from now. Electric motors. Wow. Okay, very strong magnet for its size. Tell them that's heavy, or at least feels heavy, right? Yeah. Rare earth magnet is able to hold that with very little trouble. Okay? You buy these things for like 10 for a buck on the internet. I don't recommend it. Unless you really have needs regarding holding things to refrigerators. There's really no point in having things like that. Okay, but now I took the magnet off, and you can still sort of see the imprint of the magnetic shield pattern that was left these little iron filings here, okay? And again, at its simplest, it looks like a dipole. Now, if that were all there were to magnetic fields, that was just another phenomenon that happened to resemble electricity and we don't know why, then it would be interesting, but more of an amusement than anything else. But it turns out that electricity and magnetism are deeply connected to one another. And, in fact, represent two aspects of a single force, which we now call the electromagnetic force, given the historical fact that we separately studied electricity and magnetism as a species, and then eventually realized they're really the same thing. So we'll call them electromagnetic. Okay? So if you want to have some fun, there's one of these FET demonstrators. Okay. This thing back on. Okay. And you can play around with a little virtual bar magnet. Now, what they've done is, it looks like there are little arrows here, but in fact, what the field is made out of here are tiny little magnetic dipoles. So each of these little arrows actually is like a little compass needle. It has a north pole in red and a south pole in white. And as you move the magnet around, you move the north pole of the compass on the left, and you also alter the field pattern in the space around it. Okay? And you can do things like, you can flip the polarity, so you can change north to south, and now the compass will be repelled. Okay, so the south pole will be attracted to this side. Okay. If we look inside the magnet, what's really going on is that the tiny little mini magnets that a big magnet like this is made out of are all aligned up in such a way that their north poles all point in one direction and their south poles all point in the other. And really, that's the origin of magnetism, is whatever's going on inside of this material, the way it gets its external strength, its macroscopic strength, is that the little atoms that make up the magnetic regions of, say, this iron, for instance, all have their little magnetic poles pointing in the same directions, so that you get a very strong aggregate result. Okay, so magnetism is as far as we know, and you'll see more of this as we go through this, it's an atomic phenomenon. Yeah, Frank?
How are they keep all of the atoms pointing in the same direction?
Property of the material is because the material has a fixed crystal structure. Once the atoms line up, they hold that. It's a very energy efficient configuration. Because otherwise, if their little poles were randomly oriented toward one another, they would want to then rotate in such a way as to minimize the magnetic force between them to reach a sort of an energetic happy place for the whole material.
It doesn't have anything to do with like the electrons
in there? Oh, it does. It does. But we'll get to that. Yeah, it's very connected to the electrons inside the material.
The magnet magnetic in right in the middle where the two atoms come together?
Yeah, if you were to slice this, what you've effectively done now is expose. Let's actually use this picture here. If magnetism is because all the little atoms inside the material have little north and south poles, and they're all lining up with one another, okay? If you were to just slice right here, for instance, you would then have the south poles of those atoms sticking out the back of your material now, and you get another south pole.
Yeah, but when it's still connected, mm-hmm. is the middle part to north, or what does it attract?
It's both. I mean, each piece of the length of this magnet is a little north-south magnet. You could think of it as a large sum over a very large number of tiny little magnets. The key toward macroscopic magnetism, the reason we observe it at all, is that these materials, because of their crystal structure, allow the orientation of those little magnets to be fixed. They're permanent. That's why these are called permanent magnets. I could hit this with a hammer really hard repeatedly, and that force would actually be sufficient to randomize the orientation of the magnets in it. So if you want to demagnetize something, you can strike it with a hammer. Also, if you want to magnetize something, you can strike it and try to get the force to line up all the... Like, basically what that does is it loosens up the atoms in their little crystal lattice positions and lets them kind of rotate. So you can actually magnetize the material simply by hammering it. But you can also demagnetize it by hammering it to try to randomize the orientation of the magnets. Frank, yeah?
You know how the electric field could be zero in the conductor?
Right.
Would the magnetic field be zero in the middle? Because this is on the bottom.
It's not, because the minimum configuration of this is a dipole. The magnetic field of this permanent magnet permeates the entire thing. So in its equilibrium configuration, it's a little different than electric field going through it. We'll sort of come back to that as we get more rigorous with this. But magnets have their differences. Magnetism has its differences with electricity. The key is that they're actually fundamentally related to one another, and we'll see that today. Okay. Let's get some more boilerplate stuff out of the way here. Okay, so we've already established a field convention. Let's establish some other things we need to describe magnetic fields. Units. Yay. Okay. The unit of magnetic field strength is the Tesla, named after an insane but brilliant scientist and inventor named Nikola Tesla, whose name is given to this lovely device I'm going to use in a bit, the Tesla coil. Okay, so this has the symbol of T. And a Tesla actually turns out to be a very large amount of magnetic field. I'm not sure Nikola was the one that gave this thing its name, but it's sort of fitting because he was such an outlandish character who was genius but a little insane. He reportedly built a machine that could generate earthquakes in buildings. The Mythbusters actually tested this in one of their episodes and found out they couldn't reproduce as a alleged result. But he's a larger-than-life character, and the fact that the Tesla is such a huge unit of magnetic field is sort of a testament, I think, to the outrageousness of the scale of his experiments. When he played with electricity and magnetism, he didn't play at small scale. Another unit is the Gauss, which is denoted G. Why do we have two units? Well, Gausses are sort of more Earth-friendly units of magnetic field. One Gauss is equal to 10 to the minus 4 Tesla. Okay, so that gives you a sense of just how big the Tesla is. The Earth's magnetic field is about a Gauss in strength. Okay? Let's see, what other useful magnets here? So, I've sort of said Earth's field at the surface of the Earth is about one Gauss. Fridge magnets. You think those are stronger or weaker than the Earth's magnetic field?
Stronger,
yeah, because they actually hold up on a piece of metal, right? Your refrigerator doesn't align itself with the orientation of the Earth's magnetic field. Cows do, actually. I don't know if you guys know about this, but there was a Google Earth study of herds of cattle, and the herds will preferentially line up along the Earth's magnetic field. And probably because, like most animals, they have a sense of direction that comes from the fact that the brain can detect weak electromagnetic fields. Birds use the Earth's magnetic field to navigate, for instance. So if you go back and look this up, it's a fun study, but cattle line up along the Earth's magnetic field. Thank God for Google Earth, right? Too much time or science? Isn't that? too much time may be a good argument. On the other hand, most scientific discoveries were accidents because people were not doing what they were supposed to be. Okay. So.
That just goes to show you just do whatever you want.
Well, within a framework, yes. Quiet you. study for your tests or whatever. Question? No. He'll get his revenge on me, don't he? There are some ridiculous magnets in the universe. People familiar with supernovas? All right, so, if not, a supernova is when a star of sufficient size burns and burns and burns and burns and burns for a long time, millions and millions of years. And eventually it burns enough of its fuel that it produces lots of heavy atoms as a result of burning its nuclear fuel. And as the hydrogen in the star begins to wear down, the star begins to collapse under its own mass. It can no longer use the pressure from burning hydrogen to sustain its size. Our sun, for instance, if it didn't have nuclear processes powering it, would be much smaller. Because there's so much hydrogen in it, it really wants to be gravitationally much tinier than it is. But all that pressure from burning hydrogen pushes the sun out in size. But old stars can't do that anymore. And so they give in to their gravitational self-attraction, and they begin to collapse. And if they collapse fast enough, There's a process called a supernova where they collapse and then their outer shell bounces off of the imploding core of the star. That bounce releases tremendous radiation. If you want to look at some beautiful pictures, the Crab Nebula is a good example of a star that collapsed, blew its outer shell off. All the gas you'll see in those photos is actually the original surface of the star that's been blown off. And now it's being hyper-excited by the magnetic field of what's left over. The magnetic field of what's left over is called a magnetar. Kind of a weird name, but it's appropriate. And these things have fields that are typically 10 to the 11 Gauss. These are ridiculously strong magnetic fields. So strong, in fact, that they cause huge streams of radiation to spray out from the star and illuminate the gas that was once its surface. If the star is of sufficient size, eventually it will collapse further and turn into a black hole. And that black hole will then begin sucking in material from all around it and basically eating and eating and eating forever. There's a black hole at the center of our galaxy. It's a supermassive black hole. It's dormant right now. It's not feeding. But it's probably due to go back on its feeding cycle in the next 100 million years or so. And when that happens, the center of our galaxy will actually get very bright, at least in X-rays and gamma rays. It probably won't be bright to the eye. Okay, so there are some sort of typical numbers. Earth's field is a fairly nice number to deal with. Fridge magnets are pretty day-to-day. Magnetars are not so much, but it gives you a sense of how outrageous the universe can get with these things. Okay? Here's the key. So we have this lovely thing. We can write down numbers and units to describe it. We can assign poles and names like north and south, and we can plot field lines. Okay, up till this point, it's not that much more exciting than electric fields. But it was actually a bit of an accident that led to a change in the view that we have of electromagnetism. So there's just some inventions again. It's this gentleman, Hans Christian Ørsted, who is a Danish physicist and a chemist. It's amazing that most of the people that wind up, you know, being responsible for these big discoveries that led to understanding about electricity and magnetism and then eventually light, and then themselves inadvertently launched a revolution called quantum mechanics and relativity. They were all born in the post-revolutionary eras of either France or the United States. It was a very revolutionary period. People were really, post-enlightenment, digging into science very deeply and using a lot of their unmitigated free time to do random things, because they believed that they were doing it with a purpose, and that was to come to a fundamental understanding of the universe. Plus, it was probably fun. Most likely, they spent a lot of time electrocuting themselves. Well, that's hopefully what I'm going to avoid doing today, but I'm going to reproduce first the simple version of what Ørsted observed. He accidentally noticed one day, while playing with electric current, again, I think that's code for he was electrocuting himself, okay? He accidentally noticed that, aim this a different way, let's see if I can get this to work, okay? If you have an electric current, like the one going through this wire right now, and you have a magnet, okay, well, that's not going to work very well. Yeah, I've got the thing sitting upside down. Here, let's let this regularize here for a second. Now I know what the problem is. This is a shielded cable, isn't it? Yep, this is a shielded cable. Alright, let's do it unshielded. Okay, I'm going to try to do this without electrocuting myself. This is a Tesla coil. It produces an insane amount of voltage. You'll see what I can do in a minute. But for now, let me see if I can get it to do like this. See the tiny little deflections? Let me take this away for a second. Let it settle. Oh, there we go. kind of pretend thing. Actually, I probably just wiped its probably just wiped its magnetism off by doing that. Oh well, we'll get a new compass. Ah, there it goes. Okay, so what Oersted noticed was that if you have an electric current, it deflects a... Oh, I see, the rare earth magnet brought it back to life. There we go. Now it's going crazy. If you have an electric current of some kind, this is creating a little, what's called a coronal discharge. The voltage is so high here at the end that right near the tip of this Tesla coil, it's actually breaking down the air and turning it into a good conductor. So there's a little bit of current through the air at the tip of this thing as the electrons are attempting to get to break to the surface of this plumbing, for instance. And what he observed was when you put a compass near an electric current, the compass needle would deflect. And nobody really ever documented that before. There's some discussion about whether or not Oersted was the first person to really observe this, but he was the first person to document it in such a way that actually people took notice and started doing experiments based on his observations. And in science, sadly, that's usually what matters. Okay? So Oersted was kind of playing around in the lab and accidentally observed this occurring, that a compass needle was deflected by electric current. Okay, a compass needle is not deflected by your average normal neutral conductor. If I put this on a big block of metal, copper or something like that, it doesn't do anything. But if I run a current through the copper, then the needle will start to go crazy. It will start to deflect. It's as if electric charge in motion has something to do with magnetism. And actually, that is true. It just took a little bit of time for people to sort of figure this out. Okay? The first thing you do if you think you have a force is you attempt to do experiments on it to figure out what that force is capable of doing. So this is going to be the fun part of this class. I mean, no. Relatively speaking, at least. So let me see if I can get this set up. This is a Crookes tube. Crookes tube is basically a piece of metal that sticks through into a tube that has some gas in it. That gas can be ionized by putting an electric current through it. And it's got another conductor down here that lets ions exit and then go to ground. And my ground is conveniently just the plumbing in this room today. Okay? There's a little cross, little metal cross here at the end. Okay? And what that does is it allows you to visualize the beam of electrons that gets created from ionizing the gas. So what you do is you take a ridiculous voltage, several thousand volts, which is what this is capable of producing. You put it across one of the conductors. This has a little metal plate at the end, like half a capacitor. And this sprays electric field through the material, which then breaks down the gas, strips the ions from the electrons, and then the electrons shoot out the end of the tube. This is basically the basis of old television sets. Okay, they all had one of these in them, or many of these. They were called cathode ray tubes. What makes a cathode ray tube different from a Crookes tube is that you put a phosphorus screen here on the end, so that now you can scan the beam of electrons very finely and make an image, and that image can move, and that's television. Okay, that's the big breakthrough that made television, was being able to make a moving picture on a small screen. And this thing is the basis of that. We don't really have these anymore, not even in the monitors in these classrooms. But this is the idea. Beam of electrons shooting out the end of the tube. Now, electrons striking a metal or glass or anything else also leads to x-rays. Okay, so there are x-rays shooting out the end of this tube as well, which is why I didn't want anybody sitting over here, because I don't know how broadband a beam it actually is. So I'm going to fire up the Tesla coil, and you're going to see the closest thing to a lightsaber from the Star Wars series that you've ever seen before. A lot of voltage to break down air like that. That green that you see there is from electrons striking a light phosphorescent material that's in the glass at the end, as well as the glass itself. And you can see the shadow of the cross there from the electrons that aren't able to penetrate that and strike the phosphorus. Probably also distorting my camera a little bit. It was yesterday when I was playing with this. It was the electromagnetic radiation off of this Tesla coil is sufficient to disrupt the electronics in the camera. Okay? So that's about the closest you're going to get to seeing a beam of electrons. If you, it's really hard to see in here, but there's a light blue glow through the tube as well. And that's from the electrons traveling, the electrons and the ions traveling through the gas. Okay? So we can make a pure current, a pure beam of electrons with no conductor involved, just by getting large electric fields in this material that can then strip the electrons off the atoms and accelerate them out the end of the tube. Okay? So the location of that bright spot here that you saw, the sort of it shows up as white on the camera, saturating the lens. That white spot gives you a sense of where the most intense part of the electron beam is directed. Okay? Ah, there, that was a good disruption. Okay? We're going to reproduce Ørsted's measurement using a bit fancier setup than he had. These tubes, Crookes tubes, weren't really in common use until the late 1800s, early 1900s. In fact, it's tubes like this that were instrumental in actually identifying the electron as a fundamental independent particle. In Ørsted's day, nobody knew that there was such a thing as an electron. I think at that point they still thought of it as an electric fluid, some kind of fluid that flows through space. Okay, so they didn't think it was made of particles. They thought it was literally a continuous electric medium. But we have the benefit of history. So we know that these are actually tiny little fundamental particles, you know, many Avogadro's numbers of them being stripped off of their atoms and shooting out the end of the tube, and I hope not killing anybody in the next room. Okay. So the current passing through this, according to Ørsted's observation, should be influenced by the presence of a magnet. Okay, so let's see what it does. Let's see what a magnet does to this. Watch the bright white spot at the end of the tube, okay? I'm going to pass the north and south pole of the magnet past the tube. Watch what happens to the bright white spot. Screensavers. All right, so what's happening? Yeah, it's bending. So the beam is kind of moving up and down. When I'm sort of between the poles, it's a little confused, but if I make sure that the north pole is aligned here, I think this is the north. Yep, north is the top one. Okay, it looks like the beam is bent up, and here it looks like the beam is bent down. Up, down, and then no magnet. Up, down, and no magnet. Okay? This is consistent with the studies that happened at the beginning after Ørsted's original published discovery. These two French scientists named Biot and Savard started immediately doing experiments based on Ørsted's observation. And they were able to come up with a law that describe the force that magnetic field had on charged particles. So let's think about this a little bit. We have a magnet, okay, and I was holding it perpendicular to the flow of electrons. The electrons were traveling to the left, from my perspective. The magnetic field lines, let's say from the North Pole, were going out through the tube, roughly perpendicular to the direction of the motion of the electrons. And what we observed was, for the North Pole, the electrons were deflected up, and for the South Pole, the electrons were deflected down. So if I then reverse the field direction by putting a South Pole in front of the beam, the force appears to be in the opposite direction. Okay? I can really make this extreme by using the magnet near the source of the electrons in the gas, which is closest to the metal plate. You can really see the beam swinging now. Okay, there it is. And there it's deflecting the way up. So I'm bringing the North Pole in, and it's deflecting the beam of electrons way up. Let me bring the South Pole in. And they're deflected way down. It's actually, from my perspective, the bottom of the tube becomes extremely bright when I do this. And now the top of the tube is extremely bright. Let's see if I can not block the camera. Okay, so you get some pretty extreme motion. Also, you get a really nice nice sweet ozone smell off this thing as you're ionizing the air around it. It smells like candy. Don't recommend breathing ozone for too long, by the way. So this is a little weird in the sense that in electricity, if you had an electric field that was uniform, okay, and you put an electric charge in it, like a positive charge, the electric force, Fe, would be directed for a positive charge with the field lines. But it seems, actually, let me pick a negative charge since we're dealing with electrons here. So that would be directed against the electric field lines. But if I have a magnetic field that's uniform, that's not a very uniform field, but it's close enough for this purpose, okay? And I have an electric charge that's moving this way. It's a little hard to demonstrate on this tube, but it experiences no force. So if I were to take the electric field, let me see if I can do this, okay? If I were to take the electric field and try to direct it, I still have a component that's... Yeah, this is a little too hard to do, and I'm afraid of electrocuting myself. So, you can set up experiments. It's hard to do with this setup. You can set up experiments where you put the field parallel or anti-parallel to the direction of motion of the electrons, the current. And you'll find that there's no net force, that the electrons are not accelerated in any way, their speed doesn't change, their direction doesn't change. On the other hand, if you do what we were doing there before and orient the electric current so that the electrons flow perpendicular to the field, then what you find is that there's a force. And in our case, our electrons were flowing this way, okay? Our field was this way, using the North Pole, and the force was up. So to draw the force, I'm going to draw little circles with dots in them to indicate sort of like an arrow coming at your eye out of the board. This was the magnetic force, Fb, on the electron. If I instead reversed the field direction by putting a south pole next to the beam, then the force reversed direction and went into the void from this perspective. Okay? So it seems that magnetic forces on electric charges don't work quite the same way that they do for electric forces on electric charges. They appear to cause a force that's perpendicular to both the velocity of the electrons, the direction of the current, and the orientation of the magnetic field. Okay, so again, if the field is to the right, the current is up, the force appears to be out of the board. And the law that we have now for this magnetic force is that its direction and magnitude are given by the cross product of the velocity vector of the electron. Let's think of a single electron right now. The cross product of the velocity vector with the B field. Okay, with the magnetic field. Times the charge. All right? So let's think about what this means. Let's think about our experiment. Okay? We had velocity this way, we have magnetic field this way. So this is the right-hand rule, okay, used for this. You take your fingers, you stick them in the direction of the velocity. Now you curl them toward the direction the magnetic field is pointing, this way. But there were electrons. They have a negative charge, and that flips the direction of the force. And that's what we observed. We observed that the force on the electrons from the North Pole pointed up. Okay? So if we think about our electrons for a second. This all is nice and consistent with the experiment. The force on the electron would be equal to negative E V cross B. Okay? In other words, V cross B minus sign. Okay? So for positive charges, if I could work just with the ions in that thing, which is a little hard given the setup, but if I could work just with the ions, then I would find that I would just take V cross B, and that would tell me the direction the ions were going. But for the electrons, which have an opposite charge, it flips the sign of the force. Okay, so this is where it's important, again, to keep your signs straight. This is the general formula for the magnetic force on a moving charged particle. If B is zero, the force is zero. Okay? And this is the equation for specifically an electron, which has an electric charge of Q equals minus E, where again, E is 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19 coulombs. Okay? So we've done the experiment, right? You can take these magnetic fields, you can orient them perpendicular to the current, you can actually get this law. The cross product is tricky. The dot product was nice, right? If we had, for instance, what was a good one? Say we have the work from the electric field. That was F dot dx integral, okay? Or F dot dr. But these are both vectors, but their dot product gives you a scalar, just a number. The cross product returns a vector. This force is a vector. So you need some operation on vectors that takes two of them and gives you a third vector. In this case, that's oriented perpendicular to either velocity or magnetic field. Okay? I had a math mistake in that cross product video I put together. We haven't needed it up till now, but a couple of my colleagues pointed out that I had a sign error. I have fixed the video over the weekend. Okay? So take a look at the YouTube video. It's linked off of our class notes page. The second half of it is altered now to get the sign convention to work out. But I'm just going to write down the answer here, okay? Do it over here. The x component of the magnetic force will be equal to q times dy dz minus dz dy. The y component will be equal to q times, and let's see, this is where I screwed this up before, it will be D, think about this a second, dz dx minus dx dz, and then fz will be equal to q times dx dy minus dy dx. Let me just check that mentally for a second. Let's see. Yes. Okay. So those are the components of the force that results from taking the cross product of V and B multiplied times Q. Okay. It's a bit of a mess. But if you can work with, like, for instance, velocities that are perpendicular to the magnetic field, then the... and you can call those the x and the y direction, for instance, then the resulting force will only lie along z, because it has to be perpendicular to both v and b. And the only thing perpendicular to both the x and y axes of the coordinate system is z. Okay? So if you can work with perpendicular magnetic fields, if you can set the coordinate system up in such a way, then you only ever have to worry about, for instance, the z component. These two will be zero by convention. The magnitude of the force is a little bit easier to deal with. It's the magnitude of Q, the magnitude of V, the magnitude of B, and the sine of the angle between V and B. Okay? So again, if V and B are perpendicular to each other, there's a 90 degree angle, sine of 90 degrees is 1, and you get all of the magnitude pointing along the Z direction. If that angle is not entirely 90 degrees, then you have some component that lies along these other axes, potentially. Okay? So, this will at least get you the magnitude. But remember, vectors have magnitude and direction. So if you're asked for the force, you're being asked for direction and magnitude. If you're asked for the magnitude, then just get the magnitude by whatever means is convenient for you. This can be helpful if you can figure out what theta is. Okay? Okay, so next time, we're going to move on to something a little bit more detailed, and that is exactly how electricity and magnetism both affect electrons, charges. And then we'll start talking about currents, because that's really what's going on here, is we're dealing with currents. And we'll get to the Biot-Savart law, which is the law that is considered the foundation of understanding magnetism in the form of electric currents being affected by magnetic fields. So, thanks very much.